Hi.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Well, I'm a little stressed.
Yeah.
That's okay.
Understandable.
Yeah, we're just coming down to the wire, you know?
Yeah.
It's okay. Deep cleansing breath. It's almost, well, while we're recording this, it's almost your birthday.
Yeah.
So exciting.
I'm so excited. No, I'm not. That's a lie.
Think you should be.
Excited for my party.
That's something.
I'm excited for my little trip.
Yeah, did you get that like booked?
Yeah, we're not going to the amusement park because
Okay.
it's very expensive. And I was like, is it worth it?
Mm.
But I'm going to the hot spring and to an alpaca farm to feed alpacas.
Oh, that's so cute. I really wanted to take you this year to go. I wanted to surprise you with a trip to the jeez, I can't even think of it. It's like an animal rescue,
Oh,
a farm
yeah.
animal rescue. So we could go pet cows, but I'm
Oh,
not allowed to be around farm
that
animals.
makes sense.
But soon I will be, because I think it, I have to look it up if I'm breastfeeding, if it
Yeah.
affects that. But definitely not while you're pregnant.
Yeah.
Petting zoos are a no-go. Maybe next year.
Oh,
Yeah.
I'd love that.
Maybe next year.
Maybe next
We'll look
year.
into it.
With a 1-year-old.
Yeah, and then she can
Oh.
get whatever you're not allowed to get at petting zoos. She'll put it directly in her mouth. I'll just put gloves on her.
Oh, a muzzle.
Horrible. Oh my gosh. Oh, man. So as we're recording this, it's birthday season. So it starts with my niece. Well, technically, I guess it starts with my husband, July 30th.
Oh,
Then my, not July, June
June.
30th. Then my niece, July 13th. And then me, July 23rd. Then Shirley, July 28th. And then who's next? My mom, August 7th. And then
Me,
you.
August 24th.
And then, or maybe my baby sometime in there.
Baby,
Your
August
sister,
24th.
your brother.
My brother's tomorrow.
Aw. How old is he turning?
19.
Oh, that's so weird.
I know. Creepy.
Gosh. But you know what's also weird?
What?
My nephew's 13.
Oh my God.
They're only 6 years
That's
apart.
so weird.
Oh, I don't.
That's weird to think about.
That doesn't make sense to me.
No, the math doesn't add up.
Because, I mean, whenever I met you, what? How old would he have been whenever we were in middle school?
He was born when I was in 6th grade. So he would have been one and two
Oh,
in
okay.
seventh and eighth.
Okay. And Pace was, my nephew was born whenever I was 16.
Okay.
So I guess that adds up.
It doesn't, though.
In my head, it doesn't make sense.
Makes no sense.
Yeah. Don't like that math.
No.
Not a fan of that math.
Nope. Don't like it at all. If you were born when the movie Frozen came out, you're in 5th grade.
You know Avatar? The new movie that's coming out, the first movie that came out, Avatar 1, came out so long ago that my niece and nephew weren't born.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Because they're watching the new movie trailers, and my nephew's like, "What is that?" I'm like,
You don't
wait.
remember when that took over the world?
Because it came out, I don't know when it came out, in 2000 something.
That ride at Disney World rules.
I can't believe they have like a whole place for
I
it.
know. No one even
Like,
cares about that anymore.
well, they're going to, because I think they're making two more movies after this. I think there's gonna be four total.
That's too much.
I don't know if they're gonna wait 15 years in between
They should.
each
CGI
movie
gets way better every movie.
every time. So whenever you watch them in order, you're just like, ew.
Like Toy Story.
Toy Story's so good though.
Yeah. Toy Story's better.
Oh,
Toy
yeah.
Story's better than Avatar. You heard it here first.
And last,
And probably.
okay. Well, I wanted to tell you this week before we get started. Oh, let me just introduce this real quick. Happy Fearsome Fridays. We are on Holy Gossip Girls. I'm Casey.
I'm Faye.
What are you drinking?
Nothing. Oh
Oh,
man, I don't even have water.
that
I
sucks.
know.
I'm drinking water and I'll drink it in front of you.
Oh, man.
Salaciously.
I'm offended. Jealous.
That was really good, though.
I should get a Truly at our break.
Okay, that's a good idea.
Yeah.
And then another Truly at another break.
Yeah. I'm gonna be drunk by the time I leave here.
Hell yeah. That's the way we want to be.
Yeah. I'll get drunk for two, since you can't.
Three, really.
Three, aww. Yeah. Well,
two drunk and
for three.
Two and a
half,
I guess. Are we out of weeks this week, whenever this comes out?
Yeah.
Wow. Whenever this comes out, baby will be here.
Baby be born.
Baby be born. She'll be a baby size.
Yeah. The size of an infant.
of a few week old.
Yeah. Aw.
Aw.
Sweet little baby.
Oh, I really hope she has red hair.
She's so cute.
So, we had our last baby class. Mm-hmm. And remember, so I went through a bunch of medical information with you. But I wanted to tell you because I learned about C-sections.
Oh,
and I
great.
Wanted to tell you about them.
Because
it's probably one of my worst nightmares.
Yeah.
So if you're listening to this and you just don't give a shit about hearing about this, just skip forward like 5 minutes. So they used to do C-sections horrifyingly, where they would cut you from hip bone to hip bone, take out like all your organs and put it on a fucking table.
Why?
And then deliver the baby and then put everything back in.
How do you live?
I don't know. It doesn't sound right.
No.
Right? It sounds horrifying.
Yeah.
So now what they do is they do like a small incision, like way down there, like right above your pubic area. And I'd say it's probably like, 6 inches maybe? Pretty much just wide enough to like get the baby out. And so at that point, baby's head is already down in your birth canal. So they kind of have to like push the baby back up by pushing up on your stomach, and then they have to push the baby out of the opening.
Oh my god.
So they kind of have to push the baby up, reach in there, feel the head. Oh, I forgot to say the most horrifying part. Cut you, right? They cut the skin, they cut the fat, they cut everything, and then they get to a layer of muscle. And the way that they described it, they like just take their fingers like this and they open it like a curtain and they just separate your muscles.
Ow.
Yeah. And then that's where they see the sac, and then they open that a little bit, and then that's whenever they reach in, grab the head, and then somebody's literally up here pushing, and then somebody's pulling the baby out.
It's like a bop it.
Yeah.
Human bop it. Twist it.
That's be your title. Human bop it. So gross.
That's insane though.
Like, yeah.
Is there ever a situation in which the baby does not decide to flip over?
And be breech?
Like, I don't know. Like, and be upside down.
And be head up?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh.
That's another reason why you would do a C-section.
Oh.
Yeah. So there's a lot of reasons why you would need to do a C-section. But if your baby's breech, which is head up, they sometimes will recommend C-section.
That would suck. It like puts its arms out. You can't pull it out. That would suck.
Yeah. Because delivering a baby feet first, first of all, they don't do it ever anymore. I guess they used to back in like the 70s. And in the 80s, they would push on your stomach and try to push the baby around. I think they still might do that, depending on if mom is okay and if baby seems to not be in any type of distress. I think they still do that.
Just a fun ride.
Apparently, it hurts like hell.
Oh, God. I can't even imagine. Because they're,
like, pushing really hard to get the baby to move.
Hate that.
But most of the time, if you're breech, they just schedule a C-section. But there's other reasons why you would need a C-section. And this is what horrifies me. So if it's a scheduled C-section, you are awake. Okay. They give you like either a nerve block or a epidural. So you're numb from the waist down and you can't feel anything. and they put up like a screen so you can't really see.
You can't watch.
They offer to do see-through screens, like clear ones, but I would never want to watch that. Them
digging through you.
Yeah, I don't think I would want to watch that. But you're awake, so as soon as the baby comes out and they clear the passageway or whatever, they can immediately do skin to skin.
Mm-hmm.
And then while they patch you back up, right? But if it's an emergency C-section, which happens, so say you're in the middle of labor,
mm-hmm.
a normal labor, like not normal, sorry, a vaginal birth labor, and like the baby's heart rate drops, or something happens and they're like, we got to get that baby out right now. They come in, the anesthesiologist puts you to sleep and they deliver your baby.
Oh my God.
And they said they can do it in like 3 minutes flat.
That's insane. How long does it take to come out of anesthesia?
I think it takes like an hour. But I mean, that's how long it probably takes to put everything back in too.
Yeah.
So it'd probably take longer than that. So yeah, you're asleep whenever your baby's born.
It sucks.
So like,
you tell your baby, I didn't care about your birth. I slept through it. When you're mad at them.
It was such not a big deal back in the 2022. We used to sleep through our births. Yeah. So that's my like biggest fear right now. Obviously, there's bigger ones that are more traumatic that I don't want to talk or say out loud.
Yeah.
But a big realistic fear would be that I go in and I try to follow my birth plan. Everything's going smoothly and then something happens and I have to have an emergency C-section.
I can tell that would really suck for you because you plan everything out like
yes.
to the smallest detail.
Yeah.
And if that got like all flipped around.
Yeah.
I don't mind
having a scheduled C-section.
Yeah.
I just want to be awake whenever my baby's born.
Yeah.
Cause having to get put to sleep. What if I never wake up?
Oh my God.
Like that would never happen, but like, what if, like, what if the last thing I am ever told in my existence is like, okay, we're going to have to do a C-section. Like, okay.
Just knock you out right there. And they would tell you what's going on.
Yeah. So that's the worst case scenario of my potential delivery.
Yeah.
But. We'll see. If it happens, it happens.
Worst case scenario, a gorilla escapes from the zoo, comes to the hospital. They have to lock everything down. That is the worst case scenario.
How would a gorilla get all the way up north?
He took an Uber.
Quite the travel.
He put a hat on like Joe from You and you couldn't tell that he was a gorilla.
Oh my God. Oh, jeez. Well, anyway, all right. Hope you're back, listener.
Yeah.
That went a little over 5 minutes.
I'm crying.
So now you know everything about birth.
Yeah.
Well, from my birth classes.
I'm prepared.
You're prepared. I'm excited to tell you my extremely in detail birth story.
You're going to have to write it down so you don't forget a single detail.
I'm going to never forget it.
Okay.
A lot of like my friends are like, oh, once you have the baby, you don't remember the pain, blah, blah, blah. But you'll remember the details. And I'm like, I feel like I will remember all of it. I know I'll love my baby a lot, but like, I don't think you'll just have amnesia and be like, what happened? What was the last
baby here?
24 hours of pain? How did that happen?
That's my dream scenario.
Magic. Like this.
There's a baby here.
I fell asleep and woke up and there was a baby.
I woke up a mother.
Aw.
Aw.
That's so cute.
That's cute. I love babies.
Well, that was a fun trip we just had.
Yeah. Let's talk about the opposite of birth.
Let's talk... So for the first time ever, I'm gonna present to you a three-part episode.
Three parts.
Uh-huh.
Okay, I'm ready.
And since this one we talked for like 15 minutes, it's probably gonna be a long first episode.
Okay,
but
worth it.
So this topic, this story, is a story of Ted Bundy.
Oh.
Which most people know this story, but there's just so much that happens. And he is so evil.
Yeah.
He's, gosh, I don't want to say like he's my, it's not, I don't know how to word it. My favorite person to hate of like serial killers. Uh-huh. He's so terrible.
Yeah.
I think he's up there with like, oh, the Night Stalker is pretty bad.
Oh, yeah.
The East Area Rapist, he's pretty awful.
BTK.
Mm-hmm. They're all just pretty bad. Suck. But
you know what? Unpopular opinion. I think serial killers suck. Not a fan.
How brave of you. Okay. Well, let's start like we always do with Ted Bundy's early life.
Okay.
Are you ready?
Yeah.
This is like a crazy story. Obviously, his home life wasn't that crazy.
But... his mom slept through his birth.
That's what creates serial killers. Just kidding. Just kidding. All right. Ted Bundy was born Theodore Robert Caldwell. Fun fact, whenever we thought we were having a boy, Theodore was going to be his name.
Aww.
By the way.
That's a cute name.
Maybe we'll have a boy next.
Teddy. I'd call him Teddy.
Exactly. Or Theo.
Theo.
So cute.
Teddy bear.
On November 24th, 1946, to Eleanor,
Eleanor.
Louise Caldwell and Elizabeth, at the Elizabeth Lund Home for Unwed Mothers in Burlington, Vermont.
There's a home for that?
Apparently back in the 40s, yes.
Crazy.
Because, of course there was.
Misogyny.
His father's identity has never been confirmed. Louise claimed, I don't know why she didn't go by Eleanor. Louise claimed she had been seduced by a war veteran who abandoned her soon after she became pregnant.
Rude.
For the first 3 years of his life, Bundy lived in the Philadelphia home of his maternal grandparents who raised him as their son to avoid the social stigma that accompanied birth outside of wedlock at the time. Family, friends, and even young Ted were told that his grandparents were his parents and that his mother was his older sister.
Oh, wow.
Which I feel like happened back then, which is so fucked up. Like, I can't imagine that happening now.
Yeah.
Because, like, the world isn't like that anymore. Yeah. Bundy eventually discovered the truth. Biographer and true crime writer Anne Rule. I don't know if you've heard of her.
No.
She wrote The Stranger Beside Me, which is about Ted Bundy.
No.
Oh.
Sorry, I'm uncultured.
She's, like, insanely famous for being a true crime writer.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. She has a lot of books. I haven't actually read any of them. Anne Rule, who knew Bundy personally, wrote that he did not find out until 1969 when he located his original birth record in Vermont. Bundy expressed a lifelong resentment toward his mother for never talking to him about his real father and for leaving him to discover his true parentage for himself.
Yeah, I'd be mad too.
Yeah. Bundy occasionally exhibited disturbing behavior at an early age. Louise's young sister, Julia, recalled awakening from a nap to find herself surrounded by knives from the kitchen and 3-year-old Ted standing by the bed, smiling.
Oh my god. Ted.
That would be horrifying.
But why are knives available to a 3-year-old? Shouldn't they be, like, up?
Because it was the 40s.
I mean, they should know. I don't know. Babies can't hold knives.
They were also putting radium in their mouths. Like,
that's true.
They were idiots.
They didn't know.
In some interviews, Bundy spoke warmly of his grandparents and told Anne Rule that he identified and respected and clung to his grandfather. In 1987, however, he and other family members told attorneys that his grandfather, Samuel, was a tyrannical bully and a bigot who hated blacks, Italians, Catholics, and Jews, who beat his wife and the family dog, and swung neighborhood cats by their tails.
Why? What a freak. Maybe the real villain the whole time was his granddad.
Samuel.
Samuel.
Samuel once threw Julia, the younger sister, down a flight of stairs for oversleeping. Sometimes spoke aloud to unseen presences, and at least once flew into a violent rage when the question of Bundy's paternity was raised. Bundy described his grandmother as a timid and obedient woman who periodically underwent electroconvulsive therapy for depression and feared to leave their house towards the end of her life.
No wonder she's depressed, married to that man.
Isn't that crazy that back then, like, electrotherapy was, like, a legitimate form of therapy?
You're sad. Go get zapped about it.
It's wild to me. In 1950, Louise changed her surname from Caldwell to Nelson, and at the urging of multiple family members, left Philadelphia with Ted to live with cousins in Tacoma, Washington. In 1951, Louise met Johnny Culpepper Bundy.
Ooh, Culpepper.
Isn't that the coolest That's name?
So cool.
It sounds made up.
It does.
Good old Johnny Culpepper.
You know my friend, Johnny Culpepper.
Does that mean Culpepper is his middle name?
I hope so.
That's an odd middle name.
It is.
Anyway, he was a hospital cook. So they met at a adult singles night at Tacoma's First Methodist Church. Aw.
Cute.
They married later that year, and Johnny formally adopted Ted.
Aw.
Johnny and Louise conceived 4 children together, and though Johnny tried to include his adopted son in camping trips and other family activities, Ted remained distant from his stepfather. He would later complain to a girlfriend that Johnny wasn't his real father, and he wasn't very bright, and he didn't make much money.
Oh, judgmental.
Yeah. I mean, he probably just didn't see how much, but they had 5 kids.
Yeah.
Like, come on.
How old was Ted when they got married?
Less than 10.
Oh, so that's kind of weird.
Yeah.
I'd think they'd be closer, especially if he tries to include him.
I mean, if you found out. I do wonder. Yeah, I don't know what they said about the time frame of when he found out about who his mom was.
Mm-hmm.
Can't recall. It's too far away in the story. Just kidding. All right. Bundy varied his recollections of Tacoma in later years. He described roaming his neighborhood, picking through trash barrels in search of pictures of naked women.
Okay. People just throw those out.
He also said that he perused detective magazines, crime novels, and true crime documentaries for stories that involved sexual violence, particularly when the stories were illustrated with pictures of dead or maimed women.
Oh, he's a freak already.
In a letter to Ann Rule, however, he asserted that he, quote, never ever read fact detective magazines and shuddered at the thought that anyone would. So he's all over the place.
He's a weirdo.
He told biographers that he would consume large quantities of alcohol and canvass the community late at night in search of undraped windows where he could observe women undressing or whatever else could be seen.
Oh my God.
Yeah, he's a perv. Accounts of Bundy's social life also varied. He told biographers that he chose to be alone as an adolescent because he was unable to understand interpersonal relationships. He claimed that he had no natural sense of how to develop friendships. Quote, I didn't know what made people want to be friends, Bundy said. I didn't know what underlay social interactions.
That's kind of sad.
Yeah. I'm sure he's got a lot of undiagnosed social issues.
For real.
But I think he was just a bad egg.
Yeah.
I think he came out bad.
Should have just started over with that one.
Put him back in. He needs to cook a little longer. Classmates from Woodrow Wilson High School, however, told Ann Rule that Bundy was well-known and well-liked. and he was a medium-sized fish in a large pond. Such a weird thing to say. During high school, he was arrested at least twice on suspicion of burglary and auto theft. When he reached age 18, the details of the incidents were expunged from his record. Here's his senior picture.
Oh, wow.
It's his unibrow.
It is.
Just, I hate it. And everyone talks about how handsome he is, but
they're wrong.
It's his unibrow. It's so, was that ever something that was okay?
I don't think so.
I'm like pretty open with like how people look physically.
Uh-huh.
I don't think I could get past a unibrow. I just don't think I could.
Yeah.
I'm just not nice enough. All right. After graduating from high school in 1965, Bundy attended the University of Puget Sound for 1 year before transferring to the University of Washington to study Chinese.
That's interesting.
Mm-hmm. In 1967, he became romantically involved with a classmate identified in Bundy biographies by several pseudonyms, but most commonly Stephanie Brooks. Pretty much all the women in this story have a lot of different pseudonyms.
Really?
Yeah. I don't know if they did it to like protect them.
They want nothing to do with this.
Yeah. In early 1968, Bundy dropped out of college and worked a series of minimum wage jobs. He also volunteered at the Seattle office of Nelson Rockefeller's presidential campaign and became Arthur Fletcher's driver. I don't know who that is. Political person and bodyguard during Fletcher's campaign for lieutenant governor of Washington state. So he was like up in the politics,
yeah,
like deeply into local politics.
Crazy.
All right, let's take a quick break and we will come right back.
Okay,
bye
bye.
And we're back.
Hello.
What'd you get to drink?
I got a fruit punch, truly.
Oh, it sounds so good.
It really is.
I love fruit punch, like, normally.
Yeah.
Such a, of all, like, the kids' drinks that they have, mm-hmm. I think fruit punch is, like, one of the.
Fruit punch rules.
Top tier.
Top tier.
Yeah.
Top notch.
Yeah. Fruit punch is good. Orange soda is also good.
You know what I love?
What?
The orange drink from McDonald's.
Is it not just like Sunkist or something?
It's called Orange Drink. Well, it's Hi-C Orange.
Oh, yeah.
They call it Orange Drink.
They have Hi-C Fruit Punch at some places.
Oh, yeah.
Hi-C Love is it. Just...
Hi-C is number one.
They know what they're doing. All right. Let's get back to Bundy.
All right.
All right. So in August, Bundy attended the 1968 Republican National Convention in Miami as a Rockefeller delegate. So this whole part about him in the politics and stuff, I feel like I did. If I knew this, I didn't retain any of that because
yeah,
it was
I
like
I didn't know.
It was like shocking to me. I was like,
so weird.
What a weird. Yeah. So strange. All right. Shortly thereafter, his girlfriend ended their relationship and returned to her family home in California.
Smart.
Frustrated by what she described as Bundy's immaturity and lack of ambition. Ouch.
Good for her, though.
Psychiatrist Dorothy Ottenau Lewis would later pinpoint this crisis as probably the pivotal time in his development. Devastated by the breakup, Bundy traveled east, visiting relatives and enrolling for one semester at Temple University. Bundy was back in Washington by the fall of 1969 when he met Elizabeth. Oh, I should have looked how to say this name. Elizabeth Klopfer. It's Klopfer.
That's not a real name. Clover, probably.
Clover, a single mother from Ogden, Utah, who worked as a secretary at the UW School of Medicine. Their stormy relationship would continue well past his initial incarceration in Utah in 1976. So she's like the main girl of his life.
Not smart.
Bundy became a father figure to her daughter, Molly, who was 3 years old when they started dating, and he remained in her life until she was 10, after he had been arrested.
Wow.
Trigger warning. So skip forward like 30 seconds if you are sensitive to child abuse. As an adult, Molly wrote of incidents in which Bundy was sexually inappropriate with her, including indecent exposure and sexual touching disguised as games.
Aw, poor Molly.
And trigger warning. Yeah. Gosh, you hear those stories and it's just so fucked up.
Yeah. Ugh.
All right. In mid-1970, Bundy, now focused and goal-oriented, re-enrolled at UW, this time as a psychology major.
It's a big jump from Chinese.
He's like all over the place. He became an honor student and was well-regarded by his professors. In 1971, he took a job at Seattle's Suicide Hotline Crisis Center.
Okay, bad idea.
There, he met and worked alongside Anne Rule.
Oh.
Yeah, that's where they met. So they, like, worked next to each other.
That's weird.
Yeah, and she worked next to him for a long time.
They're besties.
And she never knew, and that's why her book is called The Stranger Beside Me.
That makes sense.
Mm-hmm. So anyway, worked and met alongside Anne Rule, a former Seattle police officer, an aspiring crime writer who would later write one of the definitive Bundy biographies, The Stranger Beside Me.
Do you think she was like a little bit excited when she found out?
Well, I don't want to spoil her part in the story.
Okay.
Okay. Rule saw nothing disturbing in Bundy's personality at the time. She described him as kind, solicitous, and empathetic. After graduating from UW in 1972, Bundy joined Governor Daniel J. Evans' re-election campaign. I don't know why he didn't go to school for politics.
Yeah, he should have.
Anyway, after Evans was reelected, Bundy was hired as an assistant to Ross Davis, chairman of the Washington State Republican Party. Davis thought well of Bundy and described him as smart, aggressive, and a believer in the system. In early 1973, despite mediocre LSAT scores, Bundy was accepted into the law schools on the strength of letters and of recommendations from Evans, Davis, and several psych professors.
Why not pre-law?
I don't know.
I don't understand him.
I don't know how you go from Chinese to psychology to
lawyering. He's Barbie.
But still nothing with politics.
Yeah.
Which obviously he's good at.
Yeah.
So dumb.
He's a freak.
He just doesn't make sense.
This is the worst thing about him.
His school decisions. During a trip to California on Republican Party business in the summer of 1973, Bundy rekindled his relationship with Brooks. The first girl, okay, who went home to her family. She marveled at his transformation into a serious and dedicated professional who was seemingly on the cusp of a significant legal and political career. Bundy continued to date Clofer as well. So he's dating both of them.
Wow, this guy sucked. Now this is the worst thing about him.
Neither woman was aware of the other's existence. In the fall of 1973, Brooks and Bundy discussed marriage, and at one point he introduced her to Davis as his fiance.
Oh.
Sure. In January 1974, Bundy abruptly broke off all contact with Brooks. Her phone calls and letters went unreturned. When she reached out, When she finally reached him by phone a month later, she demanded to know why he had unilaterally ended their relationship without explanation.
I would too.
In a flat, calm voice, he replied, quote, "Stephanie, I have no idea what you mean," and hung up.
Oh my God.
A fucking gaslighter. Cold, like crazy. She never heard from him again.
Lucky.
Actually, yes. Yeah. Bundy later explained, quote, "I just wanted to prove to myself that I could have married her."
Okay, evil.
Like, what an arrogant fucking asshole.
For real.
But Brooks concluded, in retrospect, that he had deliberately planned the entire courtship and rejection in advance as vengeance for the breakup she initiated in 1968, which is probably correct.
There's this episode of It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia where a guy someone knew in high school comes back and, like, he tells this girl that he's gonna marry her. And then at the end, it turns out he was just tricking her because she was mean to him in high school. It sounds a lot like that.
I love that plot as a comedy show.
It was very funny in there, but probably not in real life.
No, a lot of those types of things in comedy shows they don't translate to real life.
It's true. A lot of it's crime.
Yeah, a lot of it from It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia is crime.
Like, yeah. Like, real bad crime.
The show is so bad.
Oh, I love it, though.
It's really good. I haven't seen it in years, though. I binge-watched all of it while I was in college.
Mm-hmm.
And then I never watched it again.
I still love it.
So, I think I graduated in 2015. So, I haven't seen the last 7 years. It's still going.
It is. I think it's, like, the longest-running live-action show.
It's recorded live?
Live-action. Like, people.
Oh.
Like, not cartoon. Because that would be The Simpsons.
Okay, I understand what you're saying.
Yeah.
I don't think so. Days of Our Lives has been on since, like, the fucking 40s.
Well, I don't think soap operas count into this.
Oh, okay. What about ER?
I don't know. I read that it was the longest. Probably comedy.
Okay. I'll have to look it up.
Yeah.
Actually, I think... Did Grey's Anatomy beat ER?
I have no idea. I don't watch either of those.
I remember reading at one point that they wanted to be ER, but I don't know when I read that. Doesn't matter.
Anyway.
All right. Oh, hey, Fuji. Is that a toy you want? There you go.
Is he excited to be a big brother?
I think so. He's been getting really protective over me.
Aww.
The other day, my mom's friend and my friend came over to her house, my mom's house,
mm-hmm.
and she was like, "Oh, is the baby kicking you, like, over here?" And she, like, reached over and touched, like, my side.
Uh-huh.
And Fuji got up and growled at her.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
You a guard dog guarding the baby?
He's like, "That's my baby." The fuck out of here.
They're gonna be best friends.
I think he's already super protective of me, but I think he's going to love the baby.
Aww. They're going to grow up together.
He's already an old man.
He still has a lot to go.
A lot of gray hairs to grow, maybe.
Aww.
All right. So, after he broke up with her, right?
Mm-hmm.
By then, Bundy had begun skipping classes at law school. By April, he had stopped attending entirely, as young women began to disappear in the Pacific Northwest. All right. This next section is called the first series of murders.
Oh, they're series. It's like mini brands.
Yeah.
Series one.
Series one. So, there is no consensus as to when or where Bundy began killing women. He told different stories to different people and refused to divulge the specifics of his earliest crimes, even as he confessed in graphic detail to dozens of later murders in the days preceding his execution. Spoiler. He told one biographer that he attempted his first kidnapping in 1969 in Ocean City, New Jersey, but did not kill anyone until sometime in 1971 in Seattle. He told psychologist Art Norman that he killed two women in Atlantic City while visiting family in Philadelphia in 1969. Bundy hinted at homicide detective Robert D. Keppel that he committed a murder in Seattle in 1972 and another murder in 1973 that involved a hitchhiker near Tumwater.
Tumwater.
But he refused to elaborate. Ann Rule and Keppel both believed that he might have started killing as a teenager, which I totally believe.
Yeah.
However, Bundy's earliest documented homicides were committed in 1974 when he was 27 years old. By his own admission, he had then mastered the necessary skills in the era before DNA profiling to leave minimal incriminating forensic evidence at crime scenes. So he is like, I was already a master at it. So he had to have killed before. Like, had to have.
Because how do you, you don't practice like setting up your Barbies. Like, I'm going to murder this one, but I'm not leaving any hair behind.
Shortly after midnight on January 4th, 1974, around the time that he terminated his relationship with Brooks, Bundy entered the basement apartment of 18-year-old Karen Sparks, a dancer at the a dancer and student at UW. This next sentence is probably my least favorite sentence in this whole thing. After bludgeoning Sparks with a metal rod from her bed frame, he sexually assaulted her with either the same rod or a metal speculum, causing extensive internal injuries. She remained unconscious for 10 days, and although she survived, she was left with permanent physical and mental disabilities.
Yeah, I'm sure. That's like, scary.
The first time I heard that on a podcast, it traumatized me.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know why that specific, it's so graphic. It's so unnecessary. I know killing is unnecessary, but like, what are you getting out of that?
Really?
Like,
I was gonna say that. Makes no
it's
sense.
Horrible. It's horrible. In the early morning hours of February 1st, Bundy broke into the basement room of Linda Ann Healy, a UW undergraduate who broadcast morning radio weather reports for skiers. He beat her unconscious, dressed her in blue jeans, a white blouse, and boots, and carried her away.
Why'd he dress her?
I don't know. During the first half of 1974, female college students disappeared at the rate of about one per month.
Oh my God.
On March 12th, Donna Gail Manson, a 19-year-old student at the Evergreen State College in Olympia, left her dormitory to attend a jazz concert on campus, but never arrived.
I wonder why.
So, like, she was on camp. She never left campus, even.
That's insane.
On April 17th, Susan Elaine Rancourt disappeared while on her way to her dorm room after an evening advisors meeting at Central Washington State College in Ellensburg. Two female Central Washington students later came forward to report encounters. One on the night of Rancorn's disappearance and the other three nights earlier, with a man wearing a sling who was asking for help carrying a load of books to his brown or tan Volkswagen Beetle. They couldn't remember the color.
Brown and tan are the same.
Yeah. I agree. On May 6th, Roberta Kathleen Parks left her dormitory at Oregon State University in Corvallis to have coffee with friends, but never arrived.
How scary to not even be safe on your campus.
I know. Or in your dorm room.
Yeah.
Or
nowhere.
Literally nowhere. Investigators from Seattle and King County grew increasingly concerned. There was no significant physical evidence, and the missing women had little in common apart from similar appearance, which was young, attractive, white college students with long hair parted in the middle. So I remember, I don't know if I go into it on here, but I remember reading to other podcasts or listening to other podcasts where it started a panic.
Uh-huh.
People were like dyeing their hair and getting cutting their hair cut and doing different side parting styles. Yeah.
That's scary.
Don't want the Bundy cut. On June 1st, Brenda Carol Ball, 22, disappeared after leaving the Flame Tavern in Burien near Seattle-Tacoma International Airport. She was last seen in the parking lot talking to a brown-haired man with his arm in a sling.
He just carries a sling around.
Uh-huh. In the early hours of June 11th, UW student Georgianne Hawkins vanished while walking down a brightly lit alley between her boyfriend's dormitory residence and her sorority house.
Wow.
The next morning, three Seattle homicide detectives and a criminalist combed the entire alleyway on their hands and knees, finding nothing. But get this. Bundy later told Keppel that he lured Hawkins to his car and knocked her unconscious with a crowbar. After handcuffing her, he drove her to a suburb 20 miles east of Seattle, where he strangled her and spent the entire night with her body. Oh, this is the part where I was trying to say, get this. Get this! He later returned to the UW alley the morning after, and in the midst of a major crime scene investigation, located and gathered Hawkins' earrings and one of her shoes, where he had left them, in the adjoining parking lot.
Oh my god.
And departed unobserved.
I think he can be invisible.
He was wearing a hat.
Yeah.
He is Joe.
He's just Joe.
It was a feat so brazen, wrote Keppel, that it astonishes police even today. It astonishes me.
Incompetence.
Bundy said he revisited Hawkins' corpse on three different occasions.
Why?
Because he did that. He's a freak.
He really is a freak.
I do go into it, but he admits to going back to their corpses and doing stuff with their corpses.
Ew.
Pretty much up until they're like so rotted he can't.
I hate this guy.
Yeah, it's disgusting. After Hawkins' disappearance was publicized, witnesses came forward to report seeing a man in an alley behind a nearby dormitory on the night of her disappearance. He was on crutches with a leg cast and was struggling to carry a briefcase.
Where does he get these things?
I don't know. One woman recalled that the man asked her to help him carry the case to his car, a light brown Volkswagen Beetle. And here's a picture of his Beetle.
Oh, that's cute. He doesn't deserve that car. I do.
During this period, Bundy was working in Olympia as the assistant director of the Seattle Crime Prevention Advisory Commission. Like, okay. Where he wrote a pamphlet for women on rape prevention.
He would know.
I want to see that pamphlet.
Yeah.
Like, don't part your hair down the middle.
Make sure your hair is short. God,
I hate him.
Be old.
Later he... Okay, just... How do you prevent rape? There's nothing.
You don't. You kill rapists. That's how.
Yeah. Like, you as a woman can't prevent rape.
Yeah.
You...
You can't. You can't even just stay in your house.
No. Like, I can't believe... I mean, it's very... It's... I'm sure that's what they believed in the 60s and 70s. They were like, oh, don't wear tight clothing and short skirts and don't be out late and don't drink too much beer. Like, whatever. But it's infuriating.
It really is. Some people still think that and it makes me so mad. Like, well, what were you wearing? None of your goddamn business.
It doesn't matter. It does not matter.
Yeah. Murder all rapists. That's the only way to stop it.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Okay. Later, he worked at the Department of Emergency Services, a state government agency involved in the search for the missing woman.
Okay.
Like, so egotistical.
Really?
I just fucking hate him. At the DES, the department of whatever that I just said, he met and began dating Carol Ann Boone, a twice-divorced mother of two who would play an important role in the final phase of his life 6 years later.
Okay.
Sorry. Final phase of his life. Yeah, no, I said that right. Okay. Reports of the brutal attack on Sparks and the six missing women appeared prominently in newspapers and on television throughout Washington and Oregon. Fear spread among the population. Hitchhiking by young women dropped sharply. Pressure mounted on law enforcement agencies, but the scarcity of physical evidence severely hampered them. Police would not provide reporters with the little information that was available for fear of compromising the investigation, which was smart. Further similarities between the victims were noted. The disappearances all took place at night, usually near ongoing construction work, and were within a week of midterm or final exams.
He got stressed out.
Weird, yeah.
Had to do some killing.
All the victims were wearing slacks or blue jeans when they disappeared. And at many crime scenes, there were sightings of a man wearing a cast or a sling and driving a brown or tan Volkswagen Beetle.
How is he not getting caught?
It's beyond. I just can't comprehend.
I don't get it.
The Oregon and Washington murders culminated on July 14th with the broad daylight abductions of two women from a crowded beach at Lake Sammamish.
It sounds like what a toddler would call a sandwich. Sammamish.
That's kind of how it's spelled. Okay. Lake Sammamish State Park in Issaquah? Anyway, five female witnesses described an attractive young man wearing white tennis outfit with his left arm in a sling, speaking with a light accent, perhaps Canadian or British. Sorry. No, I said that right.
Canadian?
Yeah, I did. Okay. Introducing himself as Ted.
Ted, come on.
Like, he used his real name.
God.
He asked their help to unload a sailboat from his tan or bronze colored Volkswagen Beetle. Four refused, and one accompanied him as far as his car, saw that there was no sailboat, and fled. Smart.
Yeah.
Three additional witnesses saw him approach Janice Ann Ott, who was 23. With the same sailboat story, and watched her leave the beach in his company. About 4 hours later, Denise Mary Naslund, 19, left a picnic to go to the restroom and never returned.
Mm-hmm.
Bundy told Stephen McCowd and William Hagmeyer, I think those are the guys that were biography writers,
mm-hmm.
that Ott was still alive when he returned with Naslund, and that he forced one to watch as he murdered the other. But then he later denied it in an interview.
Okay.
Wonder how much. Okay. I think we're good. Hang on. Okay. I was just checking our time. So, yeah, that's fucked up. King County Police, finally armed with a detailed description of their suspect and his car, posted flyers throughout the Seattle area. A composite sketch was printed in regional newspapers and broadcast on local television stations. Clofer Rule and a DES employee and a UW psych professor all recognized the profile, the sketch, uh-huh. and the car. And they all reported Bundy as a possible suspect.
Oh my God.
But detectives, who were receiving up to 200 tips per day, thought it unlikely that a clean-cut law student with no adult criminal record could be the perpetrator.
Oh my God.
On September 6th, two hunters stumbled across the skeletal remains of Ott and Naslund near, so the two girls from the beach,
mm-hmm.
near a service road in Issaquah. An extra femur and several vertebrae were found at the site, were later identified by Bundy as those of Hawkins, 6 months later, forestry students from Green River Community College discovered the skulls and jawbones of Healy, Rancourt, Parks, and Ball on Taylor Mountain, where Bundy frequently hiked, just east of Issaquah. Manson's remains were never recovered.
Wow. So he just has, like, his designated dumping ground?
Yeah. For this series of...
For series one.
Yep. So, let's take a break here and come back next week for part two, and the week after that for part three.
All right.
My sources for this story is Wikipedia. So, yeah.
This guy sucks.
This guy fucking sucks.
I hate him.
I hate him so much.
Just, you know, my pit idea is pretty good.
Yeah, the pit idea is good. It's just infuriating that so many people were like, this is him.
Yeah.
What did I say? Like five different people?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
They're just like, nah, he's a lawyer.
Yeah. He's a law student.
He's a white guy. Probably wasn't him.
Nobody with a unibrow would kill people. All right. Well, follow us on social media. We are on Holy Gossip Girls on Facebook and Instagram, at Girls Unholy on Twitter, and email us who your most favorite person to hate who's a serial killer is, and we'll see if we can cover them next.
Yeah.
At unholygossipgirls@gmail.com, and we will see you guys next for a bonus episode?
Yeah.
We'll see you guys for a bonus episode.
October 1st, Halloween.
Ooh!
The first day of Halloween.
Start of spooky season.
So ready.
Me too. All right. We'll see you guys then. Goodbye.
Goodbye.